Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Yesterday was a very important day, important for supporters and opponents of the Affordable Health Care Act, important for President Barack Obama. Yesterday, the nine justices of the U.S. Supreme Court got to the center of the debate over the president's health care overhaul, the health insurance mandate. Can the government force its citizens to buy health insurance? Justice Anthony Kennedy, thought to be the swing vote, asked the critical question.
I understand that we must presume laws are constitutional. But even so, when you are changing the relation of the individual to the government in this, what we can stipulate is, I think, a unique way, do you not have a heavy burden of justification to show authorization under the Constitution?
That was one of the many tough questions posed to government lawyers defending the health care law. Joining us now to analyze what the justices said yesterday and to give us an idea of what to look for today and in the weeks ahead is Joe Lupino Esposito, a senior fellow in judicial studies at the Heritage Foundation. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The early analysis indicates that the two key justices, Anthony Kennedy and Chief Justice John Roberts, were very skeptical in their questioning. Here's Justice Roberts questioning the administration's attorney on whether the government can force citizens to buy other projects if it mandates they buy health insurance, other programs if it mandates they buy health insurance.
So can the government require you to buy a cell phone because that would facilitate responding when you need emergency services? You can just dial 911 no matter where you are.
What does that skepticism signal to you, Joe?
Well, it looks like from Roberts and Kennedy that they're both very hesitant in going forward here. And the biggest problem that they had with the government's case was that they failed to really put out what a limiting principle would be here. So the question comes down to, you know, Roberts talking about cell phones. Justice Scalia mentioned the broccoli test that came up at the lower court level. How far can the government go in requiring things if they're willing to say, well, this will eventually affect one part of interstate commerce?
But isn't that how anything like this happens?
Well, that's a lot of the ways in which Congress legislates is based on the Commerce Clause. But we have to look to some cases, basically looking from a range from two cases in 1995, or one case in 1995 and one case in 2000, and sort of the upper range, the Wickard and Filburn case, which is mentioned constantly in this debate, a 1942 case that said an individual farmer growing his own wheat was actually part of interstate commerce because it was a commodity that could be controlled by the federal government and regulated by the federal government.
So when we hear those kinds of questions by someone like Justice Kennedy, does it mean they will vote no, or could it be that they're just playing a devil's advocate?
That happens a lot. It's very hard to read the tea leaves just based on the questions. However, it was very interesting to see the way Kennedy acted in his questioning of the government's position. And really what was important in Kennedy's perspective in particular is that in a lot of the cases where he's been a swing vote and sort of taken more of the libertarian-esque views, it's been on issues of individual responsibility and individual rights. So you're looking at like the Lawrence case regarding gay relationships in Texas. And what you find is that he's often very interested in how the individual interacts with government, and that's how his questions were addressed. So that would hint that he sees the individual mandate as violating that sort of relationship between the federal government and the individual.
My guest is Joe Lupino Esposito. He's a senior fellow in judicial studies at the Heritage Foundation. We're talking about the arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court right now regarding the health care reform law. If you want to join the conversation, we'll be on the air talking about it for about another 9 minutes. So give us a call, 614-292-8513. Conservative Justices Alito and Scalia seem to oppose the mandate, but liberal Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg came to the administration's defense by saying health insurance is a different type of product.
I thought what was unique about this is it's not my choice whether I want to buy a product to keep me healthy, but the cost that I'm foisting on other people if I don't buy the product sooner rather than later.
So seems to be little doubt where she stands. She's making the case for them.
No, I think she Ginsburg is certainly on the side of the government on this one. Again, all the justices were just trying to get out the idea of what's the limiting principle. And I think the liberal justices that were supporting the mandate were trying to direct questions in that direction. Unfortunately for the administration and the federal government, they had a hard time arguing that position yesterday.
What's coming up today now? It's about Medicaid, right?
Right. There are two issues today. The first one that's being argued right now is on severability. So that issue is, I guess, sort of each day we've been going with different assumptions. So after the first day when we heard about the Anti-Injunction Act, and we said, well, could this whole thing be thrown out simply on the issue of the tax hasn't gone into effect yet? So we got past the first day. So on the second day, yesterday, we said, assuming that that's not a problem, let's take a look at the individual mandate. So today we're going on the assumption of, let's say we throw out the individual mandate as being unconstitutional. Can the individual mandate be taken out of Obamacare and now still, and can Obamacare still exist without it? So what we're looking for today is, what's congressional intent? So did Congress intend for the law to still exist even if it did not include the individual mandate? And I think here the question's pretty clear. From all the language in the congressional record and certainly all of the media statements made by politicians on both sides of the aisle, the individual mandate is the cornerstone of Obamacare. If that's not there, a lot of other parts sort of fall apart. The government has even conceded that several sections of Obamacare would have to be stripped out in the event that the individual mandate was found unconstitutional.
Because it relies on the fact that everybody's insured.
That's correct. Right. So there's a lot of things such as the hospital, some public hospital groups wrote amicus briefs saying, you know, we favor the law. However, if it is struck down, we want our money back. So they certainly want to see that it would not be severable. So that's the first issue of the day.
Mm-hmm.
The second issue is on the states and the Medicaid provision. But what's interesting there is that, depending on how the morning argument goes, the court may never have to get to the argument for this afternoon in their final decision. Because if the bill is determined to not be severable and the individual mandate would make the entire bill invalid, that means that they would not have to answer the question of Medicaid, because that would also be thrown out.
Why is that? Why would Medicaid also be thrown out? Why couldn't the government still require the states to extend Medicaid to more people?
Well, because it was all part of the bill. So in the event that they say the entire bill is unconstitutional, then that could be thrown out. Practically, they could also simply take out the individual mandate and leave the rest of it in, which in that case, they would have to answer the question on Medicaid.
Now, that's not something they'll decide today and determine whether or not they go on to the arguments. You're talking about whether or not they ever rule on it.
Right, yeah. I should be clear on that. Yeah, I just mean simply in June when we get this final decision, they may simply, if they decide that it's not severable, that the mandate is not severable from the bill, they'll just simply probably say, because we do not find that the individual mandate is severable and the entire law is unconstitutional, we will not, you know, reach that question on Medicaid.
Bernadette in Powell, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Bernadette.
Hi. Just a quick question. I'm not even sure if it's relevant, but I'm required, perhaps by state law or mandate, to purchase auto insurance. So why not also, should I not be required to purchase health insurance?
Well, that's been one of the classic arguments that's been brought up for the last 2 years, right, Joe?
Right, it is. And the big difference here is that states do have that plenary power to make you purchase insurance. So if an individual state, such as the state of Massachusetts, wanted to require health insurance, then they could. However, at the federal government level, that's not a power that's been given to Congress. And here they're really trying to extend it past that. And that's the problem that conservatives and the challengers of the bill have taken on this.
Getting back to Medicaid, the arguments been made, whether or not it has to do with the whether or not the whole law is considered unconstitutional, because the case has been made pretty clearly that the federal government does this all the time with transportation issues, with Medicaid. It's just an extension of an existing law, but is that how they're doing it? In other words, requiring the states to participate if they want to get the rest of the booty. That's not in question.
Well, the question here is, it hasn't gone too far, that extension. So, yes, like you said, with federal highway funds, that was the original case that we looked at on this. What conditions can the federal government put on that type of funding? Here, the states are arguing that it's overly coercive this time around.
Okay. And why is it overly coercive? In what way? What is it? What?
Well, the way the plan is set up, there's going to be a lot less deviation permitted as there is now.
Okay.
It's those extra steps and the extra extension that the states are saying, now you've gone too far. You're making us insure people that we would not otherwise insure.
Chris in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hi. I had a question about, the individual mandate. It seems like a lot of the questions yesterday in the Supreme Court were about, whether this is overly, this is a mandate, right? Can you go without health insurance under the law? Under this Affordable Care Act. And it seems to me that it is legal to go out without insurance as long as you pay the penalty, in which case, how is this any different from, paying more tax if you don't buy a house or paying more tax if you, don't have children? It seems to me that this is really not a new thing the federal government's doing.
Right. Well, that's what makes this particularly interesting, because what the government's saying here with the mandate and why it really doesn't accomplish too much of what it's really trying to get done is that you can not purchase health insurance and pay the penalty. You would still be in violation of federal law, but you don't have to actually purchase the insurance. So it's even a little confusing as to what the government is requiring here and what they're hoping to accomplish, because if you can simply pay the penalty and not have the insurance, it gets a little convoluted as to the purpose behind all of this.
Right. What happens then after you pay the penalty?
Well, you're okay, but you're still considered in violation of federal law.
Right. Chris, thanks for the call. Joe Lupino-Esposito, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your insights.
Thank you for having me.
Joe Lupino-Esposito, he's a senior fellow in judicial studies at the Heritage Foundation. Coming up, we're going to talk about those block watches. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. And later today at 8 p.m., tune to our station for special coverage from NPR News. The U.S. Supreme Court considers the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's signature health care law. It's one of the most important legal and policy cases of our generation. Join host Jennifer Ludden for a recap of the day's arguments. It's special coverage from NPR News. The Supreme Court debates health care. That special coverage continues tonight at 8. Right here on 89.7 NPR News. 64 degrees in downtown Columbus. There is a chance of rain today and windy as well, a high near 72 degrees. For tonight, still windy but clear skies, a low right around 40. Partly cloudy skies for tomorrow and a high of 55. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
A block watch is a good idea. Experts say community crime-fighting efforts are key to preventing and solving crime. But in Florida, a recent community crime patrol went terribly wrong.
Hey, we've had some break-ins in my neighborhood, and there's a real suspicious guy. It's Retreat View Circle. The best address I can give you is 111 Retreat View Circle. This guy looks like he's up to no good, or he's on drugs or something. It's raining, and he's just walking around looking about.
That's 28-year-old George Zimmerman speaking to a police dispatcher after he spotted 17-year-old Trayvon Martin in a Stanford, Florida neighborhood. What happened next is very much in doubt still, but we do know that Zimmerman shot Martin and Martin died. Zimmerman says he fired in self-defense. Others accuse Zimmerman of racial profiling and acting as a vigilante. The tragedy has focused new attention on the role of community crime-fighting efforts. For the rest of the hour, we'll talk to a local Black Watch leader and police officer who helps train Black Watches here in the city of Columbus. We want to hear from you. Are you a member of a community crime patrol, Black Watch program? Why do you do it? And do you think you're properly prepared for it? Give us a call, 292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can find us on Facebook, and you also can catch me on Twitter at Ann Fisher, WOSU. So joining us now is Summer Moynihan. She is the head of the Tussing Black Watch on the far east side of Columbus. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Also, Sergeant Ken Tischler, he's a community liaison supervisor for the Columbus Division of Police. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
And Rachel Dorothy of the Colonial Hills Neighborhood Association. She's the founder of the Colonial Hills Neighborhood Association, right?
Oh, no, the Black Watch.
Of the Black Watch.
Association's been around since 1947.
Okay. And you're also a member of City Council.
Yes.
For Summer. First, Summer Moynihan, when you first heard about the Trayvon Martin case, could you relate at all? Did you say, that could have happened to my Black Watch? That could have happened to me or one of my volunteers?
Well, I think that, I think it's possible to happen anywhere. The big thing with our community is that everyone understands that you're not supposed to approach individuals that you feel are being suspicious. We are supposed to be the eyes and the ears of the police department, and it's extremely important that once you see something suspicious activity, person, vehicle, whatever it is, that you immediately contact the police department.
And as far as the Black Watch goes, when you're in eyes and ears, are you walking around the neighborhood?
No, we're not. Basically, what we ask our community to do is to go about the normal daily activities, whether it's going out and, you know, grocery shopping, going picking up the kids, going to and from work, even if you're going for a walk with your family, with your dog, whatever it is, continue your normal daily activities, but identify what is and is not supposed to be in your community. If you know that a neighbor, they come and go at certain times. You notice somebody suspicious.
You start to establish the patterns. You start
exactly,
to see them, right?
Exactly. So you identify those types of things. And all of our members are actually anonymous members. Nobody knows that they're a member unless they tell them. And we actually prefer that people don't tell other individuals that they're members because we don't want anyone to become a target.
Rachel, Dorothy, we're all worried about crime. We lock our doors, we keep our lights on. What makes you take the extra step to volunteer and organize a neighborhood Black Watch?
Well, in our community, not everyone was locking their doors or keeping their lights on. They felt that they were very safe within Worthington. We're a very small community, and they didn't see the impact of crime. Recently, we've had more vehicle thefts. We've had some break-ins, and we realized we needed to have the community involvement and the cooperation of the police department with our Black Watch. And Summer was actually influential in helping us form our own Black Watches within Worthington, but that's how it all got started. And people have come and started to wanting to communicate with their neighbors, get to know what their neighbors are doing, get to know their names, and then reach out when they see suspicious activity to the police department.
Are they trained?
The police department does put on training. They put on, they have three initial trainings for Black Watches, and they've also put on introduction to self-defense, also pedestrian safety, some social media safety, internet safety. But they've been very active in providing training over the last year.
Sergeant Ken Tischler, how has the training changed over time, or hasn't it? Is it the same as it's always been?
The basic training is always the same. It pretty much has to do with common sense things to make yourself a harder target for criminals, what the police need you to report when you observe suspicious activity. But there are new types of crimes that criminals come up with, like with the advent of the internet and things like that, with the cyber crimes, things like that, that we've had to make new presentations for.
How useful are the Black Watches? I kicked it off saying they are useful, but is that the opinion of the police department, or do you get involved and act as a liaison to control them?
We have quite a few apprehensions that we make thanks to the Black Watch. I mean, it's more than just crime solving, though. I mean, the Black Watch will bring whatever kind of quality of life issues that they have in their neighborhood to my liaison officer. And then they will try to get whatever city resources that are available to help solve that problem.
So it could be a dilapidated house, for example, or an abandoned property or something like that is what you're saying?
Yes. Matter of fact, we have trash pickup days and things like that, and we'll provide an officer there to, you know, keep them safe. while they go just pick up trash and keep their community looking good. It could be something like those complexes, like you say, an abandoned house that's a magnet for crime, and that takes a lot of work to be able to remove that house from the community.
Those signs on the telephone poles are about community Black Watch programs that are at work in that neighborhood. Do they work? Do you have any statistics show that neighborhoods with active Black Watches have fewer burglaries or car thefts or less crime in general?
I would say that most of the stuff that we have is not quantifiable, unfortunately. But you'll have, like when Jim Poole took over down on the on Summers area, and we had a lot of burglaries. And I'm telling you, he worked it hard and made a lot of arrests in coordination with the Block Watch. And Summer can tell you the burglaries dropped off. But
our crime decreased by about 80%.
But then you'll have another wave. We'll come in, or it'll take some other form.
It's hard to know what the factors were at
right.
the time.
I mean, just because you solve it once doesn't solve it forever, because it comes back. You have to be ever vigilant.
Criminals bounce around a lot. And once they see that an area is getting hit hard by a Block Watch or by the police, they'll move on to another area that isn't so heavily watched. And then they'll come back later, you know, when they suspect that individual's guard has been let down, and then they'll hit again.
What about you, Rachel? Any sense about what the impact has been? When did your Block Watch program start?
It started last January in
2011.
More neighbors are locking their cars at night. We still have thefts going through, but we did have one neighbor saw an individual in another neighbor's car that would look suspicious, called the police, and they made an arrest and solved a crime, and that was very successful for the Block Watch.
Esther and Bexley, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Esther.
Good morning.
What can we do for you?
Thanks for having me.
I was just
calling to say that the same situation that is happening in Florida is happening right in Columbus and Bexley, Ohio.
What do you mean by the same situation?
The Block Watch people is not really trained properly. They don't even know what to look for in a crisis. They're just, if you black, they think you come in the neighborhood to destroy or to steal something, and that is wrong.
Okay, well, let's talk to them about that issue. Thanks for raising it, Esther. What about, Sergeant Tischler, about profiling and that sort of thing? Does that enter the conversation in your training programs?
Well, the Columbus Police doesn't tolerate profiling at all, and we're not interested in what race a criminal is. If they're committing a crime, we want to catch them. It doesn't, you know, race doesn't enter into it at all.
But as far as working with Black Watch programs, do you talk about the problems of profiling and the dangers of profiling?
We certainly don't encourage them to go based on race. I mean, that would be wrong. So that would be something that we would tell them that you would not do. But again, we're just telling them to look for things out of the ordinary, things that you know that are out of place because you live there. That's what we tell them to base it on, not anything to do with any kind of race.
We're talking about Central Ohio Block Watch programs. Our guest, Summer Moynihan, she's she operates a Block Watch program on the Far East Side. Also, Rachel Dorothy operates a Block Watch in the Worthington city limits. And Sergeant Ken Tischler is a community liaison supervisor for the Columbus Division of Police. Do you belong to a Block Watch program? Do you think you're adequately trained? Why did you join the program in the first place? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Summer Moynihan, so what about the idea of racial profiling? Esther called from Bexley and said she thinks that this stuff goes on in Columbus and in Bexley as well.
I don't doubt that it does. And honestly, it's probably very important for her to get in touch with her police department and express those concerns. If she has specific incidents that have occurred, you know, make sure that she lets them know. We do have members, unfortunately, that are racist. And actually, it goes both ways, not just against black individuals, but also against white or Mexican, you know, different races.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are certain stereotypes that come. But it's a matter of setting those stereotypes right. And our community, you know, we are very fortunate in that we are very well versed when it comes to races and, you know, financial aspect, cultures. And it's great because we're able to bring everybody together, and we try to send them a message that our community, we are essentially what America is made of. We have all come together, and we are trying to create an atmosphere that is safer. You know, everybody wants their children to be able to go outside and play. You have the same goals. And, you know, I won't lie, we do have members that are very racist. And when I do get phone calls from them, it's difficult even just for me to sit there and listen to them bash somebody because they are a different race, or to use racial slurs. And, you know, I've gotten to the point that I just tell them, listen, I don't, you know, race is actually one of the last things that I ask about. Okay, what's going on? What activity is occurring? Okay, what does the individual look like? Because I don't want them to start off with just telling me, you know, what the individual looks like. I want to know what the activity is that's going on so that I have an idea as to whether or not that is something that we need to be concerned with, or if it is just this individual who's upset because it is a race issue. It is a
sometimes
fact. It is.
Rachel, Dorothy, what about in Worthington? What's been your experience with your Black Watch program?
Well, the Black Watch sprung from the Colonial Hills Civic Association, which strives to get community members involved and get to know your neighbors, get out, get your next door neighbor's phone number, get to know who they are, get to know if there's any shut-ins, make sure you're calling on people, getting to know who's in your neighborhood, then know what regularly happens. And then if you find someone, see someone doing something out of the ordinary or have any suspicious activities going on, whether or not there is racial profiling, I don't know, but just first get to know your neighbor, who is in your neighborhood, and then if something looks suspicious, call the police.
So you haven't noticed any racial profiling that seemed...
I haven't personally. Obviously. I don't know if it has happened. I wouldn't doubt that it has, but I haven't personally experienced that.
Sergeant Tischler, do any Black Watch organizations that you know of actively patrol?
There are some that do, yes.
And what kind, do they get a different kind of training? Do they, how do they know what to do if they're going to do that?
Well, we still tell them to go out and just be observers. We okay. don't want them to ever confront anybody.
Even if they see someone breaking into a house?
No, they should not confront them. What we want them to do is try to stay in a secure location and call us and try to give us as much detail as possible about what's going on. And hopefully they can keep them in sight until the police get there. And then, of course, be good witnesses for court.
Mark in Cleveland, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. My name is Mark. I'm from Cleveland. I'm a community activist. We have a Black Watch organization as well. I come from a police family. I was number two to get on Cleveland Police Department, so I lost my vision. So I've been around it. I know it, and I see it. Yeah, I come from a very diverse neighborhood, and it's a great community that we have. And this the thing that really upsets me with a lot of people, both black and white, we talk about it, this hitting the race issue on the subject. And the bottom line, I mean, it's so sad that a life was taken, any life, for whatever reason, and that breaks my heart. And I pray for the family, and I just pray for peace in the neighborhoods and everybody. There's always two sides to the story, and people need to remember that. People so quick jump on a bandwagon and the media, and they're going on it, and they're feeding over, you know, after everything. But we need to go and just stop, and let's get the facts first. And, you know, I'm a Second Amendment believer, and, you know, if my life is threatened in whatever way, we don't know the facts, but I'm saying, you know, the from what the tapes are showing, the man was defending himself from what it sounds like and what they're saying. But again, that's just what they're saying. Until the facts come out, we just don't know. I just pray for peace, that people aren't going to get, you know, just start rioting and causing other problems and stuff. But the bottom line, it's a shame. In our community, the same thing. The officers will train us and, you know, don't follow the person, don't apprehend them, don't try to get involved, you know, personally and try to stop it. Call the police, let them do their job. We're basically the eyes and ears of the neighborhood.
Mark, excuse me for interrupting you. Did you say you're a community activist? Are you in a Black Watch program?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Do you carry your weapon?
I do. Absolutely. That's my Second Amendment right. And it's just, to me, in my neighborhood, it's not at a certain time. It's 24/7. This is my neighborhood, my community, and it's one of my rights as an American citizen to carry my firearm. And I've come from a law enforcement family where we've been around firearms and guns and training. And I'm not some lunatic, not some fanatic at all. And but yeah, no, I do carry my firearm legally and properly.
Okay.
And it just, if I happen to get, I live in downtown Cleveland in the inner city, mm-hmm. and I've had incidents where, you know, people were going to come up and rob me, and thank God I had my firearm and the Second Amendment and the CCW, the state of Ohio, which allows us in that. And, you know, in my area, there was a lot of robberies, there was a lot of shootings and stuff. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, thank you, Mark, for the
thank
call.
You.
We appreciate it. Sergeant Tischler, what about the issue of firearms in this case in Florida? If he hadn't had a firearm, maybe there might have been a fight, but there wouldn't probably have been a death. What is your recommendation when you talk to Black Watch programs?
Problem with the firearm is, you know, it could obviously lead to consequences beyond what you were expecting. You know, you have criminal penalties that you're possibly subject to. He also has civil penalties for using that he might be subject to. And then just, you know, having been in a shooting myself, I can tell you there's an emotional cost to shooting somebody that you don't know what it's going to do to you until it actually happens. So, you know, we don't recommend having a firearm with you. But as the caller said, it certainly is your right if you can legally obtain a CCW permit in Ohio and carry one. But again, it makes every run a gun run, so to speak, which is what an officer faces. You know, even an unarmed person could take your gun from you, and I think half of the officers that are shot are usually shot with their own guns, if the statistics are still correct. So having a gun in the equation just makes it far more dangerous.
We're talking about Black Watch programs in relationship to the tragedy in Florida. If you have a question or comment, give us a call. If you're a member of a Black Watch program, let us know why you joined and what you think about whether or not you've been prepared properly for the role. 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And you can also get to us at the All Sides Facebook page. And you can tweet me at Ann Fisher. WOSU. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Your annual support of 89.7 NPR News is our largest source of income. Your gifts make up the funds we use to pay for the news programs you listen to every day. It's easy to renew your membership. Visit us online at wosu.org/renew, call 1-866-897-9678, or respond to our mailing by sending a generous check. Your annual gift provides us with the foundation of listener support. Thank you for renewing your membership with 89.7 NPR News.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. Stay with us for 20 minutes, beginning at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides, and a discussion of OSU's men's basketball as they head to the Final Four, and then Ohio standardized test scores and the possibility of cheating. That discussion on All Sides with Ann Fisher during hour two from 11 till noon here on 89.7 NPR News. And WOSU Public Media presents Chefs in the City 2012, featuring celebrity chef Hubert Keller, a host of the PBS series Secrets of a Chef, along with an elite group of Central Ohio culinary greats. The event and TV show are coming up in May, and there's a culinary-themed auction beginning online April 15th. Included will be Chef Travis Hyde of Ella in New Albany, who is showcased on our Facebook page. Be sure to like Chefs in the City on Facebook or visit WOSU.org/chefs. There is a chance of rain today, a high of 72 degrees. Windy tonight and a low of 40. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We're talking about community crime patrols and block watches. Are you a member of a block watch? Give us a call. Tell us what your experience has been and whether or not you think you've been properly prepared and why you do it. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Still with me, Summer Moynihan from the Tussing Block Watch. Summer, once again, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Sergeant Ken Tischler, he's Community Liaison Supervisor for the Columbus Division of Police. Thanks again for joining us. And Rachel Dorothy, she's from the Colonial Hills Neighborhood Association.
Thank you, Ann.
Thanks, Rachel. We have some emails. One from Quinn. Some are now trying to paint Mr. Martin as the aggressor in this situation. That would be Trayvon Martin. But what if, after being followed by Mr. Zimmerman, Trayvon was the one who decided to stand his ground, which is the law at issue in Florida and several other states? The crucial point is that this all could have been avoided, but George decided to follow Trayvon. The Stand Your Ground law prohibits pursuit. Mr. Zimmerman disqualified himself from the Stand Your Ground defense when he ignored the 9/11 dispatcher's advice to not follow Mr. Martin. And, you know, I don't know, Sergeant Tischler, in my opinion, from reading everything I've read about it, it's still not fully clear what happened and whether he did follow him or not. Are you satisfied that you know everything about this case yet?
I don't believe that we have all the facts and that we can render an accurate judgment. And again, you have to let the authorities there in Florida do their investigation. And if they decide to let it go to a grand jury, then they're the ones who will make the ultimate decision as to whether or not Mr. Zimmerman should be indicted or not. But you have to let the process work its way through the system, and hopefully they'll come out with the right decision.
Let's get back to something that Mark brought up. The caller from Cleveland carries a weapon when he's walking his neighborhood and doing block watch patrol. What is the role of the officer when they show up at a scene if someone like Mark is there with a weapon and maybe he hasn't shot anybody, but he is armed and he's there because he's trying to protect his neighborhood? What happens when the officer shows up?
You have to remember, when the officer shows up, he's probably not going to know who you are. He's not going to have any idea whether you're involved in the crime or not. But if he knows you have a weapon, it's his training to secure that weapon to make sure that nobody else gets hurt. So he's probably going to want to take it from you. Now, he may give it back to you when he finds out that you had no role in it, or it's not evidence. He doesn't need it for anything. But in his training, he wants to secure that weapon so he can be safe and keep everybody else safe.
Ellen on Facebook writes, if people are going to do community crime patrols, they should have to take part in training, in my opinion. It should be required. Let's hear from Larry now in Columbus. Larry, you're a Black Watch member. You want to talk about training. Welcome.
Yes, thank you. I am a member of the Tussling Block Watch, okay? And what amounts to is that you have to have regular meetings. And during those meetings, you have the liaison officers, and we have an excellent liaison officer in Officer Poole. Sergeant Tischler also attends the meetings. And during those meetings, it's stressed as to what you can do, what you cannot do. At the same time, you do have available to all residents of the City of Columbus the Citizens Police Academy. It's put on by the Columbus Police Department, and 9 weeks, one night a week, excellent job explaining rules of what the police department does. It helps the individuals understand what they can and cannot do. At the same time, Summer has had individuals come in as guest speakers discussing the Ohio concealed carry weapons law, what you can and what you cannot do, so that you are giving little legal limitations as to, okay, fine, if you have the CCW, you can't go out with a gun. It is a castle doctrine. You cannot go out and hunt somebody down. This is totally different from Florida because it's stand your ground.
Right, so you're saying that with your block watch program, you're not allowed to go out with your weapon. Is that what you're just saying?
Basically, Summer says, do not go out, because if they act, as in the case of in Florida, on behalf of the block watch, every member of that block watch can be held liable. So, no, she does not say, you cannot go out with us. Now, there are certain communities which do have, in the City of Columbus, watches, and there is a watch training program. program for those specific instances where they are doing watches, but they go out unarmed. They go out in pairs with flashlights and the walkie-talkies.
Okay. Is that the way it operates, Rachel, in Worthington?
Right now in Worthington, I don't know if anyone who goes out on patrol, we maintain awareness, situational awareness of where we are, and we call the police if we see anything suspicious. There's no block watch. I know just there's some block watches that are just south of us that do have people who patrol, but not within the city of Worthington.
Larry, thanks for your call. Barbara in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Barbara.
Yes. Hearing of the Trayvon Martin case, I was reminded of several years ago when two or more men in a car chased me down. I was walking down a street, and they claimed to be protecting their neighborhood. They did not quite say they were a block watch, but that was certainly implied.
Mm-hmm.
I walked down the street. There were no sidewalks. I was walking in the street in front of some man's house. And the man said to me, looked startled, and said, "Good evening." And I looked back at him and smiled and said, "It's a public street," and kept on walking.
Why were they picking on you?
Because I wouldn't tell the man what my name was. I was walking in front of his house without his permission and without telling him what my name was, and he didn't like it. He started yelling after me, "Who are you? What's your name?" And I yelled back, "None of your business," and kept walking. And a few blocks later, I heard a car coming up behind me, and I thought, well, maybe this guy called the police, who knows? But it wasn't a police car, not it did not look like a police car.
Was there something about you that was threatening?
Well, these men were white. I am white. I'm not black. I'm not male. And I'm not young. But they perceived me as a threat to something. And they treated me as such. And I kept, and the other man in the car, middle-aged, was saying, "We want a few minutes of your time." And I said, "No, thank you," and kept walking. "You need to keep your mouth out of our neighborhood." And I said, as I kept walking, that this was a public street. This is in 43214, a pretty prosperous zip code. The street connects High Street to Indianola, so lots of people have legitimate reason to walk down it. We should not have to get anybody's permission to walk down the street.
Sergeant Tischler, when you hear a story like that, what is triggered in your brain as an officer?
If you have somebody that oversteps their bounds, they're liable. So you call the police, and then we can deal with those people. And if we find out that they're in a block watch and they're acting inappropriately, then they will be asked to leave that block watch. We don't want anybody violating somebody's rights. Again, we want observe and report. Don't confront people.
Summer?
I will be the first to tell everyone that if any of my members overstep the boundaries, I want to know about it. And I will make sure that our community liaison officer talks to them. And if it is going to be a problem, I will remove them from the block watch. Because
Those kind of things do attract some kinds of people sometimes, right?
Yes. Yes. Now, I guess my question for the caller is, did you call the police?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, Barbara, did you report this?
No, it was a busy time of year for me. And as a woman, you encounter men who are rude now and then. And I'm sorry now that I did not.
Well, please do if anybody out there has a situation like that. I did have a block watch captain one time who was acting in a manner similar to what you're describing. And we pulled him in, had a meeting with him, and let him know that he was possibly facing criminal charges, and that turned him around completely, and now he has a very successful block watch with a lot of community input.
Rachel, Dorothy?
Well, what I found when I first started the Black Watch is when I called it a Black Watch, I did get a lot of male people who wanted to go out and patrol the streets. That was the first thought in their head of what a Black Watch was. And when we talked about it being more of community connectivity and neighborhood network, we had more neighbors. We had a lot more neighbors want to join up and get information from the police department. So that's just been my experience with starting up the Worthington Black Watch, but we also call it the neighborhood network, too.
Thanks, Barbara, for your call.
Thanks.
Deneen in Colonial Hills, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Deneen.
Hi, thank you very much. I just, as you said, I live in Colonial Hills, and I've been a part of the neighborhood Block Watch here. And one benefit that I just want to bring up that I've seen for the Block Watch is that it kind of gets us past the stigma of the nosy neighbor. You know, it makes it okay for us to look out for each other. And I think just having the Block Watch formed in our neighborhood has brought sort of front and center the idea that we do need to look out for each other. And so I think a lot of us have taken it upon ourselves to, you know, to meet our neighbors, to know what's normal in our neighborhood. If we're home during the day, we know what cars are supposed to be in driveways.
Mm-hmm.
And if something looks out of place, the advice we've been given through the Block Watch has been call the police. So, you know, if I'm walking my dog through the neighborhood, I carry my phone with me. And, you know, I'm not a hair trigger kind of thing, but if something really looks out of place to me, I'll take a picture of it so I can document it. And then, you know, I might call the police.
Yeah, those camera phones probably come in handy a little bit.
Well, they do. And,
license plates, if you're concerned about something, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But I just really, you know, the big thing for me is that there's been such a stigma for, you know, the nosy neighbor and you know, people getting into each other's business.
Mrs.
Kravitz.
And
that's not the case here,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really been the benefit for us, that, you know, we've just become, are in the process of becoming a more tight-knit neighborhood, and neighbors are looking out for each other, and that's okay.
All right. Well, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Ken in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Hi. What I wanted to say is that I know that there's a lot of discussion about the Neighborhood Watch, but the profiling issue, the racial aspects of this debate, this discussion, I just want to say, if you're a person of color and you've experienced profiling, or you've experienced someone who's made an assessment of you and you can tell when it's by race, it's so prevalent in your mind. You can be concerned about it. You can think about it. And you wonder if someone's going to judge you in that way, because it happens. And I think that so many people don't understand it. And some of the people that have commented, not your guests, but some of the people have called in and commented and said, you know, race is not really that big a deal. Race is not that big of a concern. It's a reality if you're a person of color. And I'm not certain how best to convey that so that people understand that you're not trying to be oversensitive. You don't know about it unless you experience it.
Well, they'll walk a mile in my shoes.
Oh, my goodness. And what is so frustrating, I know that with the heavy media coverage of it so lately, is that some people are saying, well, you know, why? It's not that big an issue, but it is. And I think what we need to do is to continue a positive discussion about it. And there are some danger signs for me. Even, you know, I love Neighborhood Watch. I love the concept. I like what they're doing. But what's suspicious behavior? And I hear that the discussion of their training, but when you ask what is suspicious behavior? I mean, criminals necessarily don't run around with black hats on and striped shirts saying, I'm a criminal. So what exactly would you be looking for? I mean, if someone's looking through trash cans, okay, that's suspicious. But next to that, how can you determine whether or not someone is doing something wrong in your neighborhood?
It's very shades. Is it Ken?
It's Ken. I've called him before. I love your show, Ann. Oh. I always tell you that.
Thank you. It is shades of gray, though. Sergeant Tischler, what do you tell people when they ask you that question?
The people who live in the neighborhood are going to know what's supposed to go on in that neighborhood and what doesn't. The police officer may not have ever worked that cruiser district before and have no idea who belongs there and who doesn't. So if a citizen calls in and says, my neighbor's supposed to be at work now and there's a car in their driveway, that I've never seen before. The police are going to come check it out. Now, if they find out, hey, it's their brother from St. Louis just came in and they didn't tell anybody that they were coming, then that'll be the end of the investigation right there.
The point is, if there's a question, call the police. Report
right.
It.
I mean, it's the police's job to sort out what is actually going on. We just get the information from the block watch, and then we have to figure out whether or not a crime occurred. If no crime occurred, then, you know, we can explain to the people, hey, you know, we got a call that this was out of the ordinary, and that's why we checked out to see what you were doing.
Thanks, Kim, for that call. Did you want to, Summer, respond to that?
Yes. On two different aspects. The first being when it comes to suspicious activity, we've had specifically individuals who have knocked on doors and said, hey, is Mike here? Well, no, Mike doesn't live here. Okay. Well, it's a common practice for individuals to go up to a door, knock on the door. If nobody responds, then they break in the house. So, you know, if you have something like that where you see somebody going knocking door to door,
right,
or looking in windows, we also had one man, and it doesn't, I hate to use the phrase that race doesn't matter, because I am what you would refer to as white. However, I'm not just white. I'm Cherokee, I'm Irish, I'm German, I'm French. You know, I'm all of these different things. And white just happens to be what the color of my skin is. But I have actually been racially profiled by individuals of different races. But we have suspects. Their race actually hasn't played into it. You know, it's been both sides. But individuals walking down the street and happening to look in all the windows of the vehicles that are parked on the street, that's suspicious. Those types of activities you want to report.
Email from Frank. I totally support the Second Amendment. I do, however, have a problem when we have people that have concealed permits carry going off and acting as security guards or an extension of our police force. We'll have to end it on that. I want to say thanks to Sergeant Ken Tischler for joining us today.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Ken Tischler, he's Community Liaison Supervisor for the Columbus Division of Police. Summer Moynihan of the Tussing Block Watch, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Also, Rachel Dorothy, Colonial Hills Neighborhood Association. Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ann.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.